loves America as his divine, messianic force to be, a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, you're too arrogant. If you don't change your ways, I will rise up and break the backbone of your power, and I'll place it in the hands of a nation that doesn't even know my name. Be still and know that I'm God. The promises of the Great Society have been shot down on the battlefield of Vietnam, making the poor, white and Negro, bear the heaviest burdens both at the front and at home. Though the civil rights leaders, for various reasons, refuse or can't take a stand or have to go along with the administration, that's their business. But I'm afraid that I know that justice is indivisible. Injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere.
Dr. Martin Luther King preaching about righteousness. Welcome to the Qumran Report. May the peace and blessings of the life-giving creative spirit be upon you and upon your family. My name is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, and I'm in the studio with my co-host, Earlene Anthony. This week, we will be talking about the strange case of Reginald Anthony Fagan. A man passionate about the environment and agriculture, he is the founder and director of the Timbuktu Resource Center. Mr. Fagan, welcome to the Qumran Report.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Now, can you tell us a little about yourself and where you grew up at, and how did you develop an interest in agriculture and the environment?
Well, I was born and raised in Watts, Compton area. And back then, that area was there was a lot of rural open space. And so I had opportunity as a kid to ride horses. My folks, we lived over in the Richland Farms area, which is a part of Compton that is kind of a farm area. And so we had horses and all that. And when I was young, you know, we would spend a lot of time going back and forth to like Mississippi and Oklahoma and Indiana. I had two granddads. My father, his father was a farmer, and then my mom remarried, and my stepdad's father was a farmer. So many summers I would be on the farms with my granddads, riding tractors and that whole experience. And then my family, we were avid fish folks, and we would always pack up the bags and head out to the local lakes and spend the weekend fishing and camping. And I was fortunate to have auntie and Aunt Frances. She loved to fish, and had the buns. They loved to fish, and it was just a great time. When I went to school, I was in the 4-H program. I was also in the FFA. Mm-hmm. And so there at Dominguez High School, I had mentors, Marion and Robert Bledsoe. And they took it upon themselves to spend time with us, and we would grow orchids, and we would compete in the various competitions through 4-H. And it was a great experience. My mother was a school teacher for L.A. School District, mm-hmm. and I was always the kid that would put the gardens in all back in the 60s. We were putting in school gardens, and it was a great time there. And It was just kind of in my blood. I must be honest, when I was real little, I used to eat dirt. So it was literally in my blood. So I always have had that connection.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what exactly is the Timbuktu Resource Center? What is that?
Well, the Timbuktu Resource Center was a vision that came to me back when I was in high school. I had always thought that when I would spend the time with my granddads on the farms and my mom being a teacher, that it would really be neat to have an educational situation that would combine agriculture and education. And so when I was young, I wrote a paper about one day I want to start a school to teach agriculture. So over a period of time, you know, I just developed the ideal. And finally, we up in San Luis Obispo, California. We were able to kind of set things up, and we did a lot of work with local farmers, and we set it up in such a way where we could, you know, reconnect people back to the land.
Okay. And what is the long-range goal of the Timber 2 Resource Center?
Well, what we're trying to do with the Resource Center is that I always tell people the Timbuktu Resource Center has four corners. Four, if you could imagine a table, and it's four legs. And the first leg would be education, training, and advocacy. And we've been doing a lot of that with the school, local schools and churches and training. I taught up at Cal State Dominguez, and we did a lot of training there. The second leg would be a land trust, because it's so important that in the urban and rural settings that there has to be a mechanism to capture the land. And the land trust, some people call them land conservancies, land banks, it's a perfect mechanism to be able to ensure that there will always be land set aside. So the resource center, that's the second leg. And the third leg would be an endowment. And what we want to try to do is we want to create an endowment, because so many times people are focused around grants. And grants are fine, but endowment forces one to be able to get the buy-in from local businesses and local individuals in the community that put money into the endowment. And then what happens, you work off the interest. Mm-hmm. And so it ensures sustainability. See, the grants, you know, a lot of times with the grants, people, they'll get a grant. And then what happens is the big push is you got to spend all the money. And then the grants sometimes create somewhat of an unhealthy competition. Mm-hmm. People will say, well, hey, I can't tell you this information because you might get the grant before me.
Yeah.
And then also the grants, it's like a puppet with strings. You end up having someone from another area dictating what your mission is. But the endowment is local. It's homegrown. So we want to have an endowment. And then the fourth component is setting up distribution.
Okay.
Distribution such as we're trying to create co-ops, that I think is so important that we create co-ops, so that a lot of times when you look at the Bristol Farms, the Whole Foods, that model doesn't work a lot of times in the inner city because the price structure is too high. But with the co-op model, what you can do is you can set it up where you can bring high quality foods along with the locally grown foods, and you can have local people working within the co-op. You can keep the price structure so that it's reasonable. Because, you know, people will go to the Bristol Farms or to the Whole Foods, but man, you spend almost a good chunk of your paycheck, and it's not sustainable. Along with the co-ops, we want to look at CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, because that's a good mechanism to help local farmers, market gardeners. Because what happens is a person will become a member of a CSA, they put so much money up front, and then throughout the growing season, they'll get like a box delivered to their home, or there'll be a location where they can pick up the box. So that's the distribution. So the Timbuktu Resource Center, it sits on those four legs.
Mm-hmm.
And then what we're trying to do within the center is to create like a commercial kitchen. Because a lot of times in the inner city areas, there's no commercial kitchen. So a lot of times what people do is they'll be making their pies and their cakes in their homes. And there's a limit there. I mean, you can't really get your product out on the shelves in the stores and whatnot. You can't really market your product unless you have a commercial kitchen. So that's one of the areas that we want to have. We want to have a museum because, as you know, there is an agricultural heritage. And one thing about the resource center is we go beyond just agriculture. We look at also environmental education. We look at things like sports fishing, because these are all gateways to reconnect people back to the land. And that's basically our mission, is reconnecting people back to the land.
Mm-hmm.
So in short, we have right now in a temporary location, we have over 5,000 books that we've accumulated. And these various books focus around agriculture, conservation, and so on. We want to get a computer lab in place because there's a lot of technology out there, computer graphics, where people can take landscape software and be able to design different types of gardens and different types of parks. And what I envision with the lab is to be able to have a situation where a kid, because, you know, nowadays the kids are into the technology.
Oh, yeah.
And they spend a lot of time with these games. And, okay, for those that want to play the games, that's fine. But there's technology where these kids can design the different gardens and we can have different competitions. Along with that, there's assistive technology, which is very important, because I know when I was young, I struggled with reading and writing. And it was that connection to the land that gave me that esteem and gave me that pride. Mm-hmm. And so if you can combine assistive technology, I find a lot of times when I'm in the garden working with folks, they'll tell me, hey, you know, I have issues with my reading. I have issues with my writing. And so they open up. The garden is that kind of place where it opens up people. And if you can show them this technology, then we can tear down some of those barriers. And we can get people to be able to live up to their full potential. So the Resource Center is kind of like a, I always tell people, like a space station. A place to ensure success. There's a lot of different projects that are going on in the community, but so many times these projects are short term. They're just something that's kind of out there for 6 months or for a year. We've got to get people reconnected to the land because we've got to make this more than a trend and a fad. We got to alter behavior. We got to get people focused around that. So those are some of the things.
That's beautiful. Now let me ask you about, what are your thoughts on, who do we have on the line?
Oh, this is Brother West trying to make contact with my dear Brother Reginald Fagan.
Here he is, right here. You have a question for Reginald, Brother West?
Well, okay. One, I want to salute you and the work you're doing, though, but I just want to call in and just say whatever I can say to support my dear brother and send my love and respect for Brother Reginald Fagan. And just to make sure that he stays strong and continues to bear witness to truth and justice, which is the story of his life.
Oh, this is Brother Cornell West.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
Hey, Brother West, how you doing, man? I know it's late back there in New York, man. I feel so honored that you would take the time to call in. Brother Cornell West, he's definitely a true leader in our community.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to stand next to Brother Fagan, and also I want to salute the work that you all do there at the Qumran Report, though. I'm telling you, you all are holding up the bloodstained banner in a moment with too many are sleepwalking, but there's some fire still alive, and it's very important to be that we support one another, you know?
Yes.
Definitely. But was Brother Reginald Fagan laying out his case, though? Because
beautiful.
He deserves all the support. All of us need to get behind him in all the different ways we can. But you all have been talking about that?
Yeah. Sound like I was talking to a young Booger T. Washington here and George Washington Carmen. Damn, man.
Lord, you know, he got a little Curtis Mayfield up in it, too. You know? You got a whole lot of Curtis Mayfield in it, man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you know,
I don't want to take your time, though, but Brother Fagan, you staying strong, though, man?
Oh, you know I am, brother. I definitely stand on the front line. That's all we can do. We got to do everything in our power to get people eating better and get the environment cleaned up and
that's
get people
right.
working. And you know the opportunities that exist within the green job arena. So we're just trying to get the everyday folks, the common folks, to come on board and be part of this. I just thank you for what you're doing. I can't say enough, brother. You're special. See, I was fortunate enough. Brother West is from Sacramento, California.
Oh, yeah.
And see, I was fortunate enough. His dad was a mentor of mine. We were all members of Alpha Phi Alpha fraternity. And his mother, she's a special lady as well. So I just feel so cherished and honored to just kind of help carry the torch. So, Brother West, I know it's late back there in New York, but thank you for calling in.
Beautiful. I don't want to take more time, but love you all. You all stay strong now.
Okay, thank you for calling in.
Definitely. Take good care, all of you. Right on now.
Thank you, brother.
Bye-bye.
Yes, that's wonderful. What I was going to ask you is your comment on organic food.
Well, you know, the organic food thing is an interesting thing because years ago, a lot of the black farmers, couldn't always afford to have all the chemicals and all the different technology and whatnot, so they were doing organic. I mean, I'm talking about all back in the 30s and the 40s. They were the original organic farmers. But here, I guess, around maybe the late 60s and 70s, there became a movement. And right now, up in Northern California, there's a conference that they do every year up in Monterey County. It's an organic farm conference. And it brings out all the organic farmers from the West Coast, and they meet and they exchange ideas, a lot of training. It's about a 3 or 4 day conference. And I haven't been able to go recently, but it's a powerful thing. In addition to that, you know, they have the annual organic food trade show out in Anaheim, which brings a lot of the processors and manufacturers together. And I've been going to that every year. But you know, organic is good, and that's where we need to be at. I mean, we need to move away from a lot of these chemicals. We need to move away from a lot of the genetically modified, because it doesn't work. Mm-hmm. And on that topic, I noticed lately there's a lot of people going to the 99-cent stores. Because, okay, you know, times are hard and people are trying to stretch their budgets. But I will say, hey, beware, you know, because a lot of that stuff in those 99-cent stores is full of pesticides, chemicals, and it's genetically modified. So the best way is to be able to grow your own. You mm-hmm. see what I'm saying? And like I said, a lot of our farmers, the farmers of color, I mean, they've been growing organic, so we got to support our black farmers, our Latino farmers, because that's the way. Mm-hmm. And so organic is truly something. I know it's hard to go to the Bristol Farms and the Trader Joe's and those kind of places, but back to the co-op.
Yeah.
If we can get these co-ops going, then that's the key for the organics.
Now, how do we make it more economical for the community members? With the co-ops, that in itself would make it more economic?
Yeah, it would make it more economic. But again, like I say, there are a lot of small farmers out there. And mm-hmm. see, with the big push around the industrial agriculture, a lot of these small farmers are being kind of squeezed out. So we got to be mindful of the farmers markets. Mm-hmm. We need to make sure that we support farmers markets. Like mm-hmm. I say, the CSAs, Community Supported Agriculture, that's another vehicle. But, mm-hmm. you know, if we can start looking at locally grown. And locally grown is really neat because it enables us to take advantage of the vacant lots, the empty warehouses. I mean, they're growing stuff on the tops of roofs.
Yeah.
You know, they're doing all kind of stuff. Different. But one thing that we have to be mindful is we got to test the soil.
Yeah.
You know, so many times people want to just put a garden out there and they don't think in terms of the fact that there are a lot of chemicals and pesticides that are out there. So to ensure organics, and see, with organics, you can't get an organic certification unless your soil has been tested, unless the land has been, you know, gone through a certain level of steps. Mm-hmm. And so it's not easy.
Yeah.
But the organic is definitely the way. It's definitely the way.
Now, let me ask you also this. We was talking a minute ago about farmer's market. And, you know, I really love farmer's market. And I remember when I used to live in the downtown area. Mm-hmm. And the big farmer's market that's mm-hmm. on 4th down there. And I used to love that because I thought all of the fruits and vegetables were so reasonable. And now, every time I go to a farmer's market, the things that stands out for me is the high prices.
Right.
For the, what do you think can assist in making the farmer's market, you know, the more reasonable for the community members?
Well, you know, it's the old economics, supply and demand.
Yeah.
We got to get more people away from the Walmarts and the Targets and get them over to the farmers markets because, see, these smaller farmers, you know, when you look at the labor intensity that they have to go through, see, the whole organic process, see, mm-hmm. with the commercial industrial farms, I mean, they're out there, it's all mechanized, they're picking stuff before it's ripe. And so, yeah, they can get you this stuff real cheap. But, you know, this is your temple. Mm-hmm. And so sometimes, you know, we can invest in the hairstyle and the fingernails and all this other stuff, but we got to invest in what we eat.
Yeah.
And so you may have to pay a little bit more, but it comes down to volume. Mm-hmm. And that we got to support these smaller farmers. Okay. So if they can get enough volume, then they can bring their prices down.
Mm-hmm. Beautiful, beautiful. Mm-hmm. The other thing you mentioned that I really like is about the commercial kitchens.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think that's really feasible around for a place like L.A. with all of your great cooks that come from the South. The thing that I was talking to my moms about when we was down South this time is how can we ensure that cooking knowledge is passed on from generation to generation? Because we got a lot of little families and stuff like that that used to eat, and they take their family to these fast foods, to the McDonald's, and you know, gotten away from the, how can we develop the commercial kitchen thing that you was talking about more?
Well, what I'd like to do with that commercial kitchen, like I said, is open it up to a lot of these smaller folks that are cooking and, you know, preparing different pies and cakes and whatnot. But in addition to that, set it up as a test kitchen.
Mm-hmm.
Because, see, there are certain types of produce out there that can be developed into products that people can eat. A lot of the churches, now, this is something I've been looking at, a lot of the churches have kitchens that sit mm-hmm. idle. Mm-hmm. And that right. if we could just work through setting up different ordinances, work with our local leaders to develop certain policy to enable these churches to open the churches up for the local cooks to use.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a great mechanism. Yeah. So by setting up this commercial kitchen as a hub and then bringing in maybe some of these corporations, these organic food corporations, to help to bring the state-of-the-art type of technology out there. And then also offering cooking courses. Because, you know, when we were young, yeah, all the schools, they had the different
that's right,
classes. But you go now to the schools, homemaking class, home economics,
yeah,
you'd be hard-pressed to find that.
Yeah.
And so with the schools and the churches, you have kitchens that are sitting idle. And so we need to, with the commercial kitchen, use that as a catalyst to try to create a whole wave of folks that can get back into the community and start teaching people. There was a slow food movement going, and I really like that whole idea of slow foods.
Because,
you know, the big push now is everybody wants fast
food. Yeah.
And you see what that has caused. You got people unhealthy and not eating right.
Overweight.
And you know how it is. When you cook that food slow, ain't nothing like that pot of greens and stuff. And I mean, it just tastes much so better. And just imagine if you got that garden in the backyard and you bringing this stuff out of the garden, and you're getting it and you're putting it in there and you're cooking it. I think we get people back into that. It's going to take a little time, though.
Mm-hmm. Now, one more question before I move. Talk a little about the your work experience and the compensation. You know, I remember when I was coming up down in Greenville, Mississippi Delta, one thing that was a constant, and you mentioned one of it, is just about everybody had their little garden. You could go out the back, healthy food. And the other thing was the concept of canning food.
Yes.
How they would take this food and can, and they made it last during the winter and all that kind of stuff. Is that a process that still go on out here in Southern California, or have we lost that?
I think we've lost it. It goes back to the home economic courses that we just talked about. They're not offering that. Now, when I was young, my grandma, we used to have an apricot tree in the backyard. And boy, she would can that apricot jelly. Boy, that was something else.
Yeah.
And when I would go back to Oklahoma and Mississippi, they had the little pantries, I forget the term, but root cellars.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd go down there and they would have all that stuff on the shelves and stuff. Because, you know, then people knew that the weather was changing. Mm-hmm. And so they ate by the seasons. So it wasn't always, well, I can just go down to the store and get it. You had to can your stuff. And, you know, you'd always have a lot of extra in your gardens and stuff. So, you know, you would can those items. Mm-hmm. But I really wanted to say this, too. You know, L.A., we've got an earthquake coming. It ain't if we're going to have one. It's when we're going to have one.
Yeah.
And it would be so important that if the churches and the different groups in the community would look at starting to can and starting to set aside stuff. Because you never know when we're going to have an earthquake. And that we need to be prepared. So, but canning is definitely something that needs to be back into the schools.
That's right.
Some of the churches, I'm working with some churches now to set up, because a lot of our elders, they have those skills.
That's right.
It would be a sad day to have all that knowledge go.
Lose
that knowledge. So we do need to capture that, because the canning is definitely something to look at. And you got to freeze dry. There are other different ways that you can go about saving and making sure we always have something set aside extra.
Okay. All right, now, look, let's talk about your work experience. Tell us a little about your work experience, and then how did the problem with the work compensation cases develop?
Okay, well, I was fortunate. Like I said, I was sitting on various boards. I got involved and went up to San Luis Obispo, California, and I was part of the 4-H and worked my way up from a district to a state level. And I was traveling around the country doing different projects. Was fortunate enough to sit on various boards. I was a national 4-H judge. I was also involved with Robert Stanton, who was part of the Clinton administration. Mm-hmm. And he was the first African-American director of the national parks. And so we had opportunity to travel all around the country. And what we did was we made some corrections on some of the different parks. The stories weren't quite accurate. And so Mr. Stanton, his whole motivation was we need to go back and tell the truth. And we need to make sure that the interpretive aspect of these parks reflects the truth. We can't have the Native Americans always being the bad guys. Mm-hmm. We can't have the African Americans being left out. Mm-hmm. And we definitely have to include the Latino component. So that was really a great experience. I was also part of this group called the Teddy Roosevelt Conservation Alliance. And this was an organization that was putting pressure on U.S. forestry because there was a backlog of about $2.3 billion where the mining and the logging industries had basically dominated that resource. And so a lot of the trails and the docks and ramps were being neglected. And what we did was we traveled extensively around the country looking at ways of putting pressure on U.S. Congress to, because Teddy Roosevelt, when he created the national parks, they were for the people. And what had happened over a period of time, like I say, the mining and logging industry had dominated those resources. Mm-hmm. But we found that the dollar would generate more when it came to fishing and hunting, camping, versus, say, with the mining and logging industry, it would do more damage. It would impact those resources in a negative way. Mm-hmm. So I had opportunity to work on that. I was even fortunate enough when Willie Brown was Speaker of the House, he put together an organization called Blacks in Agriculture. Mm-hmm. And this is like back in the 80s. And we used to meet every 2 months up in Sacramento. And back then, it was like we calculated maybe about a tenth of 1% African-Americans involved in agriculture, like this back in the 80s. So his whole strategy as Speaker of the House was to expand the amount of African-Americans and people of color within the realm of agriculture.
Yeah.
So when I went up to San Luis Obispo, I had all that knowledge and experience, so I was able to become a seasonal ranger with the county of San Luis Obispo. And along with some other folks, we organized fishing programs up at Lopaz Lake. And we had about 1,000 kids. And we taught kids how to fish. We got poles and stuff and gave them out to the kids. And it was a moneymaker for the county, as well as we also did stuff with recycling and we did outreach. We'd go out to the schools and do all kind of talks around environmental education, conservation, and so on. So I did all that, but I was one of the few African-Americans that they had working up in the county of San Luis Obispo. So it was just always this proverbial carrot. One day we're going to allow you to be a full-time ranger. But after 3 years of not getting that, and I had about 20-some certificates. I was a boat operator. I did all kind of stuff. I went to school in the evenings and was really excited behind the idea of being a ranger. I found that it was just a facade. Mm-hmm. And so finally, after being forced to have to work in an unsafe, unhealthy environment, I went on and brought in Cal OSHA. And Cal OSHA cited the county of San Luis Obispo 50 times. And out of those 50 times, 30 of them were serious violations. Oh, boy, that set the stage. And so then I moved from being the token to being a monster. They were calling me a monster up there. And what it was I didn't go up there looking for trouble. But the reality is they had us working using equipment that was outdated. We were cleaning out these portable toilets and the raw sewage would splatter on us. And so after about a year or so, I got hurt on my job. And so then they decided, okay, we're gonna pay you back, Mr. Whistleblower, Mr. Black Whistleblower. We're going to show you. Because like I say, you know, California, the rural part of California is different than, say, down south. Down south, you have a little bit more of support systems in the rural areas. But in California, you know, unless you work for the prison or work for a military base, you're kind of out there. And so they decided that they were going to show the outspoken African-American, put him back in his place. Mm. I learned the term placism. I learned the term demonize, villainize, character assassination. And so they just basically, it was a modern day lynching. Mm-hmm. And they abused the workers' comp system to teach me a lesson, to pay me back. Mm-hmm. And I mean, the irony is they spent over $100,000 going after a guy that never received no money. I never received any money from workers' comp, no benefits from workers' comp. But Social Security, when they examined me on the first time around, I was able to get Social Security for my injuries. Mm-hmm. But yet, San Luis Obispo decided, no, we're going to deny you. And this is not just something that's pertaining to Reginald Fagan. This is a systemic problem. I mean, it's going on all over that injured workers are basically being denied their benefits. And what's happening is a lot of these insurance companies are what they call cost shifting. They're taking the money that should be going to these injured workers and they are showing record profits. You see what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. And a lot of these law enforcement agencies, what they're doing is what they call prosecution for profit. And so whereas in the past, they might not even consider these workers' comp cases. But now, like I say, the district attorney up in San Luis Obispo was able to get over $100,000 beating me down, mm-hmm. violated my human rights, my civil rights. But I didn't lose, you know, my motivation. I mean, I just had to kind of reinvent myself.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So part of definitely within the orbit of what Michelle Alexander was talking about in The New Jim Crow, her great book dealing with all of that. Let me ask you one more question before we take a break for our community calendar. What do you see some of the major problems about workers' compensation?
Well, like I said, workers' compensation has got to a point now, because for so many years, the media has spent the workers' comp to make the injured worker to be the bad guy. Now, when you look at the numbers, 1% of workers' comp fraud or workers' comp abuse is the injured workers. The other 99% is the insurance companies,
doctors,
lawyers. They're making out like bandits. But see, when you get hurt on your job, you lose your source of income. And so what ends up happening, you spiral down. Yeah. And what they do is it's a waiting game. They wait you out. I mean, yeah. I've met people 8-10 years waiting for benefits. And when you do finally get some money, after the doctor gets his, the lawyers get theirs, it's little or nothing. Yeah. And so it's a systemic problem, mm-hmm. and it really needs to be addressed. And people need to move away from this notion of, oh, well, he was trying to get over on the system. Yeah. I'm sure in this audience, in your listening audience, that people can say, well, I know my brother, someone in my family, or I know my neighbor, mm-hmm. or someone down the street got hurt on their job. It impacts our communities. Yeah. When you lose the ability to work, it impacts our communities in a very negative way. Mm-hmm. And I just think that the people need to rise up and they need to address that, because what is happening is, like I say, they're draining the Social Security, the SSI, the disability benefit. Those are being drained while the insurance companies are showing record profits.
Yeah.
Doesn't make sense.
Yeah. Okay. Let's take a break for our community calendar, and then we're coming back with our in-studio guest, Mr. Reginald Faye.
This is the community calendar for the month of January 2013. The Veterans Community Workshop will start back on tomorrow, Tuesday, January the 8th, from 5:30 p.m. to 8 p.m. The workshop is free to veterans and non-veterans. The location is the Vortex, 2341 West Olympic Boulevard, Los Angeles, California. This is near the corner of Santa Fe and Olympic. Also, the number 60 and 66 Metro bus stop right at or near the corner. For more information on the workshop, you can call 213-908-6587. And on Saturday, January the 19th, from 8:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m., there will be a grant writing boot camp. And this will be at the Rock Art House. The location is 10231 Haynes Canyon Avenue, and this is in Tahunga, between Day Street and Apperson. We're asking you to mark your calendar and join others in the grant writing boot camp. And this is for the nonprofit administrative and programs, and is sponsored by Drama Stage Qumran and the Haynes County Colony. The unique Rocky Art House is nestled in the Angeles Forest foothill of Tahunga, 12 miles north of downtown Los Angeles. The registration workshop fee is $25, and late registration at the door will be $35 per individual. Some of the workshop topics will include grant writing 101, fundraising, foundation research, mission statements, setting goals, establishing objectives, defining success, and many more topics. For more information on the grant writing boot camp, please contact 626-703-1230. And on Sunday, January the 20th, from 1:30 p.m. to 3:30 p.m., the United University Church Peace Center and ICUJP Interfaith Communities United for Justice and Peace and Drama Stage Qumran present an interfaith gathering to celebrate Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and his legacy on the triple evils of racism, poverty, and militarism. And there will be other dramatic readings and excerpts from speeches from Dr. Martin Luther King. The location is the United University Church Fellowship Hall, 817 West 34th Street, Los Angeles, California. And this is a free event. All are welcome to attend. Contact information is 818-605-7188. Upcoming guests on the Qumran Report will be Monday, January the 14th, 2013, Louis Rivas, Andy Griggs, and Susan Stouffer. If you have a community event that you would like announced on our show, just send the information to dramastage1@yahoo.com, attention Earlene Anthony. And our call-in number for the show is 800-893-9562. Now back to our host.
Thank you, Miss Earlene Anthony. We're back with our in-studio guest, Rachel No. Anthony Fagan. And also joining our roundtable discussion is my co-host, Earlene Anthony. But before we get into our roundtable discussion, I would like to play a short interview I did with my sister, Dr. Hattie Johnson Tyler, from the Mississippi Delta in Greenville, Mississippi, my hometown. We talked about the public education in the Mississippi Delta and the nation. I conducted the interview on Christmas Day 2012. Interview is a little less than 9 minutes. Okay, can you give us a good comment? What are your thoughts on the tragedy that we had a little over a week ago with the Newtown, Connecticut shooting?
Okay, I think it was very tragic what took place, and I'm not sure anyone could have foreseen what was going to happen, and I'm not without compassion. I am, however, concerned that there seem to be those elements who are using such a tragic situation to move forward their own personal agenda. For example, the issue of arming teachers in schools. The hard truth is that in many instances, the school shootings are committed by white students against white people. And it really doesn't have a lot to do with what is happening in major cities or small rural Mississippi Delta communities, majority black areas, and what have you. But if a public law is passed legislating the arming of teachers in schools, then the schools that are likely to be affected by that are public schools, because private schools pretty much operate on their own charter. And here in the Mississippi Delta, we have academies, and the public schools are majority black or other. And for example, Greenville Public School District is probably 95 to 98% black, and the outlying areas would be pretty much in the same key. So if we have teachers armed in public schools, then the majority of student teachers bearing those arms are going to be black students with weapons to use against black students who are not a part of this phenomenon. So that would be my concern.
Also, what kind of effect would that have upon teachers who are there to teach if they have to also carry weapons or maybe take a chance of shooting somebody?
Well, it's been pretty clear now over the past decade or so that we're moving much more toward a prison industrial complex rather than a public education system. we're building prisons. They're not even building public housing anymore. And students are being trained to become good prisoners, not good workers. Jobs, for the most part, are outsourced to China or other countries, and as such, the poverty level increases. I think it's by design, and I'm very concerned long term what this will mean for public education. And I speak strictly in terms of public education because, in large part, in the South, especially the Mississippi Delta, public education means black education.
So, okay, what do you think can be done to improve the public education system?
I believe the system is broken beyond repair. For example, if you have a coffee cup and you accidentally drop it on the floor and the handle falls off, you can take some super glue and stick the handle back on. And even if you don't use it for a coffee cup anymore, you might be able to use it as a planter or something else. It could still have some possible use. But if you drop that same cup on the floor and it shatters into 100 pieces, the only thing you can do is sweep it up and throw it away. The system is so fractured and so broken that the band-aids that are being used no longer work. And the children in public education are being blamed for a broken system and are now being considered, in large part, throwaway children. Even if a student is able to matriculate through the system, in many instances, they cannot afford to go to college because the parents don't have jobs. And if they get to college and are able to complete the college experience, in many instances, they don't have jobs. Mm-hmm. So we have a system that is only serving as political fodder. The people on the ground are really being left to fend for themselves. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure what the answer is, but I do believe that in another 20 years, we could be sitting and having this exact same conversation just as we had it in 1954. We had it again in the early 70s with forced integration, and we're still facing the same situation now. And now there are those who want to literally kill the messenger. They're talking about putting guns in schools.
Okay. One more question, we'll close out. Is there a major difference between the public education system in the South, like the Mississippi Delta, and as opposed to the system that you see in the cities like, say, Chicago or Atlanta or Detroit or Los Angeles, Washington, D.C.?
There's a mindset about our children. And in large part, public education in this country means black and other minority education, especially when we speak of inner cities or rural schools or the Mississippi Delta. One problem in the Mississippi Delta would be that underfunded schools, underprepared teachers, in many instances, it is the job. It's the major employer in the region, such that if a person is not committed to teaching, they might go to college or university in order to get a degree to teach because they need a job. And many of the people, let's say some of the people that are teaching our young people, are not committed to the betterment. They have a mindset about the students, a negative mindset that they've bought into, that they themselves do not believe our students can succeed. If children learn what they live, if a student is taught by someone who is condemning or negative, even if they're standing and saying the right words, but still their energy is negative and has already decided you're never going to amount to nothing. Even if you graduate, you're not going to go to college. Your mama didn't go to college. Your daddy, what? That's you know. Mm-hmm. So in inner city, we may have better equipment. We may have better educated teachers. Many of the teachers here, not most, but many, have had so much trouble passing the National Teachers Exam that they've had to take on alternative approaches to certifying the teachers because we need warm bodies in the classroom. So yes, there's a very big problem. Mm-hmm. Public education is broken. Mm-hmm. It's not working.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Hattie Johnson Tyler. And this is Melvin Ishmael Johnson, the Qumran Report, down here in my hometown of Greenville, Mississippi, on Christmas Day 2012. Yeah, great interview. Okay, that's Dr. Hattie Johnson talking about public education in the Mississippi Delta and the nation. And we're back in the studio with our in-studio guest, Mr. Reginald Fagan. I want to ask you something in relationship to that about the Timber 2 project, which I think is such a great, great concept. What are the problems? How hard is it to make that part of the education system?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up. And just to kind of tailspin on what the sister just shared, a lot of the schools, like I did about 26 schools over the last 4 years in the L.A. area. And a lot of the schools, it's this notion that agriculture is not that important. I mean, a lot of schools, they have vocational programs that are just sitting idle and that they're underfunded and that there's just this philosophy that, you know, it's backwards, agriculture. And you know and I know that so many of our kids, it's hands-on. You know, so many of our kids, they won't be doctors. They won't be lawyers. But they definitely can learn the skills. And it's not just, say, gardening, but, I mean, it's a lot of things, working with iron, working construction, all those are good-paying jobs. And so I found when I was working with the schools that we were able to generate almost $250,000 in donations from various industries. But if I even dared to ask to get paid, I was looked upon as, what do you mean you want to get paid? Mm. And I'm a master gardener. I've been a master gardener for, 14 years. But this notion that, okay, we'll put these volunteer master gardeners over these agricultural programs and they will be sustainable, it's madness. I mean, you got people that go to school and have studied agriculture and they're being laid off. I had a guy out in Carson. He got his pink slip. We had a program that was thriving. And the LA school district, they gave this man his pink slip and just said, hey, we don't need your services. Those programs can sustain themselves. There's different ways that you can generate revenue where those programs are self-sustainable. Mm-hmm. Another thing that I found is this notion that people that live in these communities, inner city communities, can't run their own programs. That you have people coming from other communities that feel that, hey, we can do it better. And I call them carpetbaggers. And so you have these carpetbaggers that want to hook up with these poverty pimps. And so what they do is they put together these programs that are not based on sustainability, but based on just getting some quick money. So you'll go into Compton, for example, and you see all these projects like the Compton Creek. $8 million was spent on the Compton Creek. And it was all about improving the quality of water. It was all about a watershed program and to look at altering behavior. But if you went to Compton Creek 10 years ago and you go now, it's no better, but the $8 million is gone. Nickerson Gardens, same thing. I was overworking in Nickerson Gardens. And people from outside the community, they had a proposal with the Department of Labor where they were paying each other $175 an hour. These folks had nothing to do with the projects. And I can go on and on and on. I mean, Cal State Dominguez, it's the same kind of issues going on. So you've got these individuals that feel like it's their God right. It's manifest destiny, that they are the only ones that have the knowledge. And it's wrong. What has to happen is it has to be grassroots. You've got to get local people involved. I mean, there are a lot of people that have been gardening and fishing and stuff for years. And they need to be empowered so that they can be in control of the programs in their community.
Okay. Also, I also want to mention, we mentioned Booker T. Washington, and I remember going back years ago when you had Dr. W.E.B. Du Bois talking about the talented 10th, and Carter G. Woodson came along. Well, Dr. Du Bois felt that 10% of the free African slaves could get educated and reach back for the 90. Carter G. Woodson came along later with the Miseducation of the Negro, his great book, to prove that the 10% would have less in common with the 90 than they would the main society. And everybody looked up on the practice. They looked down on the practical education that Booker T. Washington was talking about at Tuskegee Institute, about learning how to be carpenters, till the land, build your own house, et cetera, like that. I want to lead that into three historical communities that we've had here: Mount Vaya, Mississippi, Boy, Oklahoma, and Allensworth. I think we got a little time to read about Allensworth, and then I'm going to get your comment on what happened to these communities. Read Allen.
Allen Allensworth. He was born April the 7th, 1842. He was born into slavery, escaped and became a Union soldier. Later, he became a Baptist minister and educator and was appointed as a chaplain in the United States Army. During the American Civil War, he escaped by joining the 44th Illinois Volunteers and later served 2 years in the Navy. After being ordained as a minister, he worked as a teacher, studied theology, and led several churches. In 1880 to 1884, he served as the only black delegate from Kentucky in the Republican National Convention. In 1886, he gained an appointment as a military chaplain to a unit of Buffalo soldiers and served in the U.S. Army for 20 years. By his retirement in 1906, he had been promoted to lieutenant colonel, the first African American to reach this rank. In addition to his work in developing churches, he was notable for founding the township of Allensworth, California in 1908. It was intended as an all-black community to be free of the racial discrimination faced by so many at the turn of the 20th century. It was the only California town to be founded, financed, and governed by African Americans, although environmental conditions inhibited its success as a farming community and the residents abandoned it. Much of the former town has been preserved as the Colonel Allensworth State Historical Park. It marked the founding dream and the thriving community that developed for some time.
Okay. Can you quickly, we still got a few minutes, comments on those three communities, the challenges that they faced, and what happened to them, or just on that one?
Well, you know, Allensworth, let it be known that the Klan, they put poison in the waterways. Mm-hmm. They did not want to see a township of African Americans thrive. So this was a plan, and when you go back to Langston, mm-hmm. Oklahoma, which is still thriving, the university there, Mount Baal. Mm-hmm. I mean, the black township movement was really something to kind of special. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a time when people of color, African Americans, felt that they could go out and create their own self-contained communities. And I think today that might be something that we need to look at bringing that model back.
Bringing it back.
Yeah, we okay. definitely need to bring it back. And okay. the Timbuktu Resource Center can be the bridge.
Beautiful. On that note, can you tell us those for who want to get in contact with you or more information about the Timbuktu Resource Center and to also talk to you about speaking engagements? How do they get in contact with you?
Well, right now our website is under construction, and so we can definitely use some help in that area. But you can reach me at 310-748-4987. Once again, 310-748-4987, or you can email me at fish, F-I-S-H, Fagan, F-A-G-A-N, the number 7, at yahoo.com. Fishfagan7 at yahoo.com. And let me leave you with this. There's no culture without agriculture.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Oh, thank you. Okay, now I would like to extend a special thanks to my co-host Earlene Anton, my in-studio guest, Mr. Reginald Anthony Fagan. Please check out our past shows of the Qumran Report on iTunes, Facebook, Skidrow.la, and Dramastage.Qumran. Thank you for tuning in to the Qumran Report. From your host, Melvin Ishmael Johnson, may the peace and blessings of the life-giving creator spirit be upon you and upon your family.
Somebody make you think that God chose America as his divine messianic force to be a sort of policeman of the whole world. God has a way of standing before the nations with judgment, and it seems that I can hear God saying to America, "You're too arrogant."